My love, she speaks like silence, without ideals or violence. She doesn't have to say she's faithful, yet she's true, like ice, like fire.
That's Joan Baez singing Bob Dylan. Before I introduce you to my guests, we need a moment, not a whole minute, but just a moment of silence about what happened earlier this morning. I think, you know, life does go on, but it's not going on for 50-some people and their families and their friends. So be quiet for a second. And don't get inundated by the intense coverage. I know you want to know what's going on, but it becomes redundant and it softens the blow, and this is a heavy blow. One of the most charming sentences, it's not quite the first sentence in her fabulous book, Anna Pinkney's Ina's Kitchen, Memories and Recipes from the Breakfast Queen. It begins like this in a chapter titled From Brooklyn to Breakfast, and it's a short chapter, as are all the chapters in this book, because there are a lot of recipes here. My mother hated to cook. I love to eat. You can see where this is going. Ina, welcome to the show. There is no way anybody could see where your life is going. It is beyond everything and beyond your notoriety here.
You have
had a fascinating life. Do you appreciate that?
Yeah, I have always appreciated that. You know, starting out life as a disabled child, I had polio when I was 18 months old. I knew I was never going to fit in. By the time I was six, that was really very clear to me. And even though I tried very hard to fit in, and you can tell by the fact that I had 21 jobs in my life and I was fired from 19 of them, you can see how hard I tried to fit in. But I knew I would have to forge my own path and find my own way.
Your parents were, however, your mother. There are two things about Ina. There's a remarkable documentary out about her life that was hooked on the closing of her notable restaurant a couple of years ago, actually in 2013, a remarkable documentary. And then you have this equally remarkable book. There's a haunting thing in the film. Your mother felt it was guilt-ridden about the polio that afflicted
you.
Yeah,
we lived in Brooklyn in a big apartment building, and she must have struggled and suffered. So where did she take me, where I got polio, where none of the other kids in the building got polio? And it was a building teeming with children.
Sure.
And I don't know how she coped with that her whole life, because that was tragic for her.
She didn't like to cook, so what did you eat as a child?
Well, it's funny. We kept kosher, and the kosher butcher thought we were a family of seven or eight because of the amount of meat that she bought. I never saw anything green except a wedge of lettuce. I never saw salt at all, some canned vegetables. We did a lot of meat in my family. It wasn't until I got married and left the house that I understood, oh, my God, there's a whole world out here.
Your father and grandfathers were, I sense from the film and your book, incredibly nurturing to you. I mean, they were good people.
They were. My father's father died early, and I was named for him. But he was an early adopter of technology. He came over from Russia, and he had a butcher shop in Philadelphia. And he was the first one to have water-cooled coils in the meat locker instead of the blocks of ice.
Wow.
And I think that's where I get my early adoption.
Like the Steve Jobs of his time.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, exactly. My other grandpa was a milliner, and he was in New York City. And he was really the one that that I was enchanted by, as everybody was. Grandpa Sam was the best.
You were something, though, and I remember this from the film. You were something of a polio or no polio. You were something of a doll in high school, weren't you?
Well,
And you knew it. Yeah.
But here's the deal. I never had a date. Do you know, remember, I was disabled. And in teenage years, that is really the outsider-ish.
Yeah.
You can't get more outside than that. And so I thought I looked okay, but that didn't matter. I really never had a date. Ever. You hear me out there, the people who didn't date me?
All you guys who are sorry now. How does one compensate for that? I have to believe you probably compensated by being an extraordinarily good friend to your girlfriends.
Mm-hmm.
By being, and this happens to some people, by nurturing your personality and your outgoing style that is
I tried a couple of personas on. You know, I was the clown. because you could get positive reinforcement that way. I was incredibly smart in grammar school. So I was the envy of all the kids when I was sitting in class, but I was prey when I got into the schoolyard. So I had to navigate.
Would you be teased and
constantly?
Really?
Constantly. Kids are mean. You know that.
I remember.
You've seen it, you know.
I remember. How does one deal with that? How did you deal with it?
In many different ways. You know, I had to be smarter and I had to outsmart them. I also had to figure things out. So if the kids said, and we lived in Brooklyn at the time, let's go to the playground, which was a couple blocks away, they would leave me behind. But if I would say, why don't we meet at the playground after lunch? Then I could start early and meet them there and at least be part of whatever it is. Now, maybe I only held the end of the rope, the steady ender, and I would do that because I couldn't jump. And then when it was over, they would leave, and they would leave me behind. But that was easier to get home by myself after it was over than to be left behind when they went.
Interesting point.
You figured it out every day in a different way. I became very resourceful.
Well, and very self-sufficient, too.
Very.
The other thing, the other upside of that kind of growing up is you wind up spending a lot more time with adults than you might than an ordinary kid or a kid totally able-bodied kid would.
We were sitting out front of our big apartment building in Brooklyn, and everybody would bring their lawn chair out and sit down, or the kitchen chair. And the kids were running and playing, and I was sitting with the adults. So what I learned was adult conversation. I learned to be a committed listener. And I learned to be very mindful of what I was about to say.
Interesting.
So that if I had something to say and they turned to look at me, what I had to say had to be valid.
Yeah.
So I learned a lot.
What did you, at that age, what did you aspire to do?
You did have
a lot of jobs.
Yeah, I did have a lot of jobs. The thing that I think every kid who's been ill as a child or disabled as a child, I think you take on the people who've helped you. And I really wanted to be a doctor. I really wanted to be an orthopedic surgeon. And even when I was 15 and had a major surgery done, I took out my own sutures. I convinced the doctor that I could do that.
That's a pretty strong girl personality.
Yeah. Oh,
excuse me, doctor. I'll handle this.
I'll handle this, doctor. Here, doctor. And did. Took them out.
Nurse, give me that scalpel. Yeah.
So I thought that's what I wanted to be. And then I was pre-med in college and then cut my finger one day and fainted at the sight of my own blood. And that was
that's
the
not
end.
Good
that was
for
the
med.
End.
That was that's the not end. Good for med school
no,
at all.
I didn't
all.
Know what I wanted to be when I grew up. I had no clue, which is why I had so many jobs.
Yeah. What job did you flip from job to job to job? What were
well,
some
first
of
all, let me say it must have been a hell of an interview if I kept getting jobs.
That's
right?
True.
Because
I don't doubt that for a second. What were some of those?
Well, the best ones I had, and I was not fired from being a junior high school English teacher in East Harlem. I was not fired from that. I worked at a bartering company. I managed a toy showroom. I was an assistant administrator to the Department of Psychiatry at Roosevelt Hospital. One day I wrote out a list. I just can't remember them all, but they were varied.
How could you?
They were a film distribution company, a furniture, managed the office of a furniture company.
You know what it's like? It's like, you know, it's the perfect back book copy for the great proletariat novels, like what Steinbeck did.
Yep.
I am spending this whole hour with Ina Pinckney, who you remember from Ina's Kitchen, of course, but who you should now meet through this wonderful book. You people who listen consistently, people like Shirley Craven, know that I am not a foodie.
Right.
I certainly like food. I certainly have to eat food. This book, there are recipes in the book, memories and recipes. I'm totally taken with the memories. And I'm so taken with the book that I'm even thinking, okay, I'm going to go in a kitchen, and I can't cook anything, and I'm going to try to make something that's in this book. As a bold experiment. They're actually, I know, before we take a little break, even a culinary cretin like I could make this stuff, right?
Yes, you could.
You
the
think so?
Foolproof pancakes you can make in a jiffy. They're simple. Everything in
there
is simple.
I love the foolproof part.
But remember, I'm self-taught. I baked my first cake when I was 37 years old.
I know, and we will get to that momentarily. That's Joan Baez singing about her one-time boyfriend, singing the songs of her one-time boyfriend, Bob Dylan. Ina Pinkney, you found a really cool boyfriend, didn't you?
I did.
How did you and Bill Pinkney, who some of you may have got that name's familiar, isn't that name's familiar? He sailed around the world some years ago.
1990 to 1992.
How did you meet Bill?
I walked into a restaurant, a cafe in Greenwich Village with my friend Susan. And for the upper middle class Jewish girls going into the city, because I lived in Long Island, yeah. The city was, that's where the draw was.
Of course, and the village and was the village.
Oh my God, the village.
Freedom.
And it was Sunday of Memorial Day weekend. And I said to Susan, oh, look, there's our friend John sitting way back there with his little girl. And she said, yeah. And I said, well, who's sitting next to him? And she said, I've never seen that guy before. And I was thunderstruck. And I said, I'm going to marry him.
This is a girl who had you dated by that point?
Hardly ever.
Bill was black.
Yes, still is.
Still is. He's 80 years old now, and he's faded a little. He's not as black as he used to be, but he's faded a little. That's great. He still is. Did that give you pause for a moment?
No, remember.
What year was this?
That was 1965.
Okay. Okay.
It was rough in those days.
Yeah.
But remember what I said? I had to find my own path. I had to figure out my own life. I knew I was never going to fit in. I wasn't going to marry an accountant and live in a split-level house. It wasn't me. I just had to figure out who Ina was and what Ina wanted.
But in part, and I keep trying to put a good face on having polio, but having polio gave you a sense, I think, of independence. You didn't rely on the cute guy from the football team. You didn't rely on, you know what I mean?
I had a lot of time for introspection. I had a lot of time
to know yourself,
who I was. And Bill was the man I knew I was going to grow up with. And it was absolutely clear to me. Wasn't so clear to my parents, who rejected me for a very long time.
Was their reaction certainly immediate? Did you bring him home or did you just tell them?
First I told them.
And what
they were
say?
Very upset and thought, you know, I'll get over it. Mm-hmm. And then we went out there to tell them we were getting married. And Bill the Mensch,
yep.
Sat down and he said, I love your daughter and I will always take care of her. And we'd like you to be at the wedding if you can. And if you can't, we understand.
He really does sound like some guy.
He was. And the way he
and still is.
Yes. The way he described it, I think, is so visually perfect. He said, let's pretend we've just checked into two rooms in a hotel with adjoining rooms. Both of the doors are locked. I want us to unlock the door and open our door. So if there's ever a day your parents unlock their door and open it even a crack, they will not come face to face with a locked door.
Wow.
And he was the one who made sure we were always available whenever they could come around.
What did Bill do?
He was working when I met him, he was an X-ray tech. And then he knew that the world was changing and he wanted to be part of it. And he had great artistic ability. And he decided he was going to become a makeup artist because black women were then being used in models as models
sure.
and TV. And he became the first black makeup artist to ever be in a department store to do an in-store promotion because white companies didn't think white women wanted a black man to touch their face.
Well, there were also, as you point out, not in the book, but I don't think, but in the in the film, it's pointed out that 17 states didn't want a white woman marrying a black man either.
It was against the law for us.
Against the law.
I was supposed to go see him in Little Rock, Arkansas, on our anniversary, and he said to me, you can't come. If you check in as my wife, you could be arrested. And that's when I didn't understand America anymore at that point. But then he became the first black makeup artist in the film union, and he became the head of that. And then he became the first black cosmetic director at Revlon Cosmetics.
And what were you doing at this time? You're flitting from job to job.
Job to job. I had a lot of jobs.
You were on job number 14 at that
maybe
point.
Maybe later. I don't remember.
Job number 14 at that point.
And then we moved to Chicago.
You came to Chicago in 74.
77. For 74 for just a year, and then we moved back.
And in 74, that's not when you ate at Le Perroquet all the time.
Yeah.
Do people remember Le Perroquet?
Oh, my God. My favorite place.
And you bring up the fact that I was a kid. I was driving a cab then, so I probably wasn't eating Le Perroquet.
I probably.
But it was a three-course lunch for $7.
Seven, and it was a lot of money.
Yeah. And it wasn't kosher.
No.
No, it wasn't kosher.
Was it?
When were you first? That couldn't have been your first exposure to.
No. In New York City, we had eaten lots of fine dining, and Le Perroquet was the finest here.
Yeah.
And there were no credit cards in those days.
Well,
and so Bill got me a house account.
A house account.
And I could go once a week, and then Jovan would send the bill to Bill, and he would pay the bill, $7 for my lunch.
You have the perfect Jewish wife, aren't you?
Oh, perfect.
perfect Jewish wife. What did you cook at the time? I mean, were you?
I was cooking. I'm not a great cook. But I was cooking. I was learning to do all kinds of things.
Did it interest you? Did food and making food interest you?
It interested me more to go out to eat and see what was being done, and especially following the service pattern. I was always fascinated with how people were being served.
Huh.
Even at Le Perroquet, you never heard a fork hit a plate from a busser or a server. If you did, Jovan's head would spin and he would look right at the server, who was already shaking in their boots. There was something about being served well that I really appreciated and took in.
That certainly sunk in.
Yeah, it did. That was important to me. And so when I baked my very first cake at age 37.
Yes, that's in the book. That's in the movie, too. But again, I'm telling you to buy this book, Ina's Kitchen, Memories and Recipes from the Breakfast Queen, which is a legend. I will, in the second half hour of the show, read you. She has the most amazing collection of jacket quotes that I have ever seen.
They're
from all walks of life. And I'll tell you about them. Why did you bake your first cake?
I had an idea for a surprise birthday cake delivery service. Everybody was sending you balloons and strippers and singing telegrams, and nobody sent you a cake. So I came up with this idea about a tuxedoed butler sending you a cake, bringing a cake to you with a sparkler on it instead of writing on the cake, because I didn't know how to do that. A parchment scroll done in calligraphy that said, "Happy birthday, Rick. We think you're the best friend we ever had." And I was talking about it on the roof deck of our building to some of my neighbors, like, "What do you think about this?" And they all thought it was great. So the next day,
who could not think that was a great idea?
It was a great idea.
Yeah.
So the next day, a Sunday, I'm reading the New York Times Magazine section, and there was a cake that had no flour in it, the very first flourless chocolate cake. And I'm looking at this cake thinking, oh, my God, I would eat this cake in a minute. And the phone rang. "Hi, Ina. My name is Diane. I got your number from the doorman. I heard what you said on the roof deck. I'd like to order your service for Friday." And I went, okay.
You didn't say, uh-oh,
no.
I have to make a
cake. Entrepreneurs say yes, and then they figure it out.
Yeah.
So that was the beginning of me understanding that I was an entrepreneur and why I always got fired. I always ran departments like it was my own business.
You're saying you're doing
doesn't
this
work
wrong.
In
We're
the corporate
wrong.
Doesn't
yeah.
work in the corporate world.
It sure doesn't.
So I thought, I'm going to make this cake. Now, I never separated eggs, I never beat egg whites, and I never melted chocolate before. So I tried to make the cake.
You're
Good
making
luck.
This recipe from the New York Times, a flourless chocolate
Good luck.
Cake. And?
A disaster. So I left the house and I went and bought enough ingredients for three cakes and said, if I can't figure it out in three cakes, I will go find a cake.
You know what a lot of other people would have done? They would have gone out and bought the flourless chocolate cake and then pretended it was their own.
Oh, but
not
there was
you.
No there was no flourless shortcakes around.
You couldn't get
this was
anywhere.
Like the first time I'd ever seen that. In Chicago at the time there was a lot of Austrian, Hungarian, Kirschwasser, buttercream.
Right.
Not my kind of cake.
Right.
I wanted something very spectacular. So I was starting my last job, which turned out to be my last job the next morning. The fabulous former husband Bill Pinckney put on a tuxedo, did the calligraphy on a piece of paper, went downtown, did the delivery so we would understand what was involved. And then came back, and the woman called me, and I said, "Diane, you know you were the first, so tell me everything good, everything bad." She said, "Ina, It was elegant and fast and surprising, and the cake was out of this world delicious, and we ate it all up. But at least the guy had this thing to take home to his wife, the scroll, and he didn't have stupid balloons to take home on the bus. I think it's great. He didn't have a stripper to try to sneak in the closet at home. And I said, so how can I improve this? And she said, well, you don't charge enough. And it was 1980, and it was $25, so that minute it went to $35. Now, the big now that word spread from those 10 people, went to so many. I was hiring out-of-work actors to show up at my office at lunchtime. I baked it home at night, brought the cakes to work, and yes, I got fired from that job, too.
Oh, I'm sure you
did. And then Wally Phillips called me on the air.
Wally Phillips of this very radio station.
And ordered it for Irv Kupcinet at the Sun-Times.
The great Irv Kupcinet, columnist at the Sun-Times.
And Aaron Gold wrote about me in the Tower Ticker.
Aaron Gold in the Tribune.
And I was done. I was made.
Wow. How many cakes were you making a
day? Well, you know, I was doing
that.
But I was doing the service. And then somebody called one day and the magic question, can I just get the cake? Oh, yes, I said. And he said, what else do you do? And I said, what else do you want?
Wow.
And I had a business.
You had a bakery.
I had been saving recipes all my life. I just never made them.
That, ladies and gentlemen, is Ina Pinckney. We have taken her from her childhood in Brooklyn to creating this business. One of the most inspired ideas I've ever heard. She has a bakery in Chicago. After the news, we were going to discover. Well, first, you know, I really want to talk to you, too, Ina, about the restaurant scene in general. You know, we talked about Le Perroquet, and it seems, it does seem now so old-fashioned. It was a great restaurant, no question, but so old-fashioned. And you decided to, again, kind of break the mold here. Ina Pinckney is here. Her book is Ina's Kitchen, Memories and Recipes from the Breakfast Queen. Lovely photography by a guy named Stephen Hamilton, and lovely. The photo of Ina on the cover of the book is fabulous. She looks beautiful, but I must tell you, the picture of Ina at about a year and a half years old in here will make your heart sing. It is the cutest little girl, except for Fiona, that I've ever seen in my life. We have taken Ina Pinckney from childhood in Brooklyn, talking about having polio and how that sort of maybe inhibited her playing in the playground with kids, but made her went a long way to help making her the bigger than life personality she is, and also the nicer than nice personality she is. We've taken her through coming to Chicago with her husband, Bill Pinckney, who is black, was black and still is black. He's 80 years old, lives in Puerto Rico. If you're down there and want to take a catamaran out or whatever it is, look for Bill Pinckney. Mm-hmm. He sailed around the world, so he must be able to take a short cruise outside of the harbor. The harbor, and yeah. See, this is a great thing. Well, what's your background, sir? What's your experience? Well, I sailed around the world. Oh, I'll go out with you. did your parents ever warm up to him?
Yeah, it took a very, very long time. Very long time.
How many, like, after 10 years, they said, well, I guess they're serious about each other.
Yeah.
You started baking in Chicago. You got noticed by Wally Phillips, Irv Kupcinet, and Aaron Gold, which was, in the time, ladies and
that
gentlemen.
That was the triumvirate, right?
Yes, that's the triple crown of PR in Chicago.
Yeah.
Julia Child also showed up.
Yes, she showed up at my restaurant one day. There was a big meeting, and the restaurant show was in town, and there she was. I invited all the women from the Les Dames d'Escoffier Women's Food Society, to which I belong. And somebody said, oh, there's Julia. And all I could think of was, oh, we don't have any Julia in our chapter. And then I did the classic double take and went, oh, my God.
And she was nice.
And after she died, and they disassembled her kitchen to put it in the Smithsonian, her assistant sent me things from her kitchen, a ladle and a spatula and a pot holder, and a beautiful note saying Julia wanted you to have these things.
How sweet. When did you decide to open a restaurant?
Well, I baked for 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, I started that and
right.
I started baking. And every morning, Bill and I would have breakfast out. But before we left the house, we had to figure out what we wanted to eat because we could stop at six different places
right.
before I got
to
the storefront. And not everybody had a good breakfast. This is the 80s,
mm-hmm.
so coffee was horrible.
Oh.
And if we wanted a good French toast, maybe two places. If we wanted a good omelet, maybe three. So we had to figure out what to eat before we left the house. And then we would eat. And somewhere in the 10th year, I went, can't anybody make a really good breakfast?
And you decided.
And Bill said, Ina, you're playing with butter, flour, sugar, and eggs every day, and nobody knows those ingredients better than you now, and what are we eating?
That's a big leap, though, Ina Pinkney, from having a successful bakery to
right.
having a...
Right.
I don't care if it just serves.
Right.
The restaurant business is among the most difficult businesses in the world. The failure rate is...
Without doubt.
Huge.
Right. So, but I knew, remember what I said about watching service patterns?
Yeah.
So I knew what I wanted you to feel like sitting in that chair. Just like Steve Jobs knew what he wanted you to feel like holding the phone.
Right.
I knew what I wanted you to feel like in that chair. So I already knew that there was always going to be a thermal pot of coffee on the table. Why? Because when you go to a bad restaurant and you have bad coffee, you can probably figure out how to make that coffee palatable. And then the minute you take that sip and go, well, I can struggle with this coffee, the server comes by with a pot. You want me to warm that up for you? And if you say
honey,
if you say yes, it screws up the coffee then for the rest of the meal. And if you say no, you will never see her again as long as you live. So I knew right away there was going to be a pot of coffee on the table.
Your location when you opened.
In Lincoln Park.
Yeah, first in Lincoln Park. Good location.
Well, it was a bad location for the four restaurants that came before me.
Wow.
Four restaurants in 5 years.
Didn't that give you pause? Were you so confident in your...
Yes.
Because you hadn't done a restaurant in your notion.
I knew. It was a daytime corner. I knew it needed sunlight in there, not a nighttime. It was the old single file for those of you out there who were single filing in those days. And then it was a bunch of restaurants. So it was the perfect corner, and we had a backyard, and we enclosed that to make more seating. We had a line out the front door the first day we opened, because remember, I had 11 years of baking for people.
Sure.
Now, I said in the movie what I did was probably illegal, so now we can reveal it here as well.
Oh, sure.
I issued my own currency.
Bucks, right?
That crowdfunding, right?
Yeah.
So I said to you, Rick, you give me $10 cash, and I'll give you $11 in Ina Bucks to spend at the restaurant. 10% return on your investment right this second.
Immediately, yeah.
Some people gave me $10 and some people gave me thousands.
Wow.
And very few turned them in. They really knew that I had baked with their families for all those years and that I would produce a really good restaurant.
How long were you in that location?
5.5 years. The landlord just wouldn't renew the lease.
You then made a leap into what now is the hippest area in Chicago.
Streeterville.
Famous
Streeterville
went
first.
To Streeterville. That's right.
A bad business partnership, and I left the business, and I was out for a little while until I found Randolph Street.
Right. And you were the pioneer on Randolph
Oprah
Street.
Oprah and me.
That's right. Oprah
there was
and
nothing
you.
There.
Nothing.
It no.
was
hookers on Lake Street on Friday afternoon when
no
the
question.
Truckers got paid.
Sure.
That was it.
Why there?
Well...
I mean, I'm sure the rent was reasonable. It's a beautiful space.
It was a beautiful space. It had free parking.
Good
free
point.
Parking. 10,000 square foot parking lot. Free parking.
And
because people said to me, you're crazy to go there. And I say, free parking. They go, oh, we'll be there.
We'll be there. And your crowd followed you.
Mm-hmm.
On the back of Ina Pinkney's book, which is called Ina's Kitchen, you can get it's very easy to spell, very easy to look up on the internet, and you can find it anywhere.
Wherever books
Elif
are
is
sold.
Gonna, if you don't buy it for the recipes or Ina's beautiful face on front, Elif will feature the picture of Ina as about a 12-month-old, and you'll buy it for that reason. I'm just going to read I'll read a couple of the full quotes, but here are the author quotes on the back. Chef Gail Gand, who's really famous, Jim Rose, who is a sports anchor, David Axelrod, who gave us President Obama, frankly, Art Smith, who is a very, very good chef, and Sarah Paretsky, who is among Chicago's leading authors. Here's what Sarah writes, because I love Sarah. Part memoir, part cookbook, all heart. That's what Ina's Kitchen is. If you think you're woman or man enough to cook like Ina, the recipes are here. But if you want the heart, you want the stories. Powerful, poignant, and funny by turn. They'll keep you on the edge of your seat while you're eating 6 or 10 or 12 heavenly hots. You did have one of the things that always, I'm never there enough, but I would go there with like mm-hmm. Jane and Bernie Solland.
Oh, yes.
You treated everybody. That place was a place where the playing field was level. You know, I suppose if President Obama walked in, he might get a little something special because the restaurant would be closed. But that was, I think, I know, one of the hallmarks of the way you ran a restaurant, was it not?
It was. It was the most integrated restaurant in all of Chicago. Because if everybody thinks about where they've eaten recently, you don't see a lot of African-American faces.
You don't
see a lot of young gay people. You just don't see it in all its forms. And we had it all.
Yeah,
we had it all, and that was important to us. We also never revealed to people in the newspapers who was there. I didn't need that kind of press.
Thank God.
So if Diane Lane was having breakfast, she was having breakfast, and we didn't tell anybody she was there.
See, that is.
It was important to me that it.
Yet another reason to.
But also remember, we had a lot of movers and shakers because it was very quiet. We had no music. Tables were well spaced.
Yep.
It was a lot of sound absorption so that you and I could whisper and be heard.
Yeah, and you didn't have, you know, there was virtually no foot traffic in those days on that stretch of mm-hmm. Randolph Street. Hookers waiting to meet the guy at the truck
We
drivers.
Had a sidewalk cafe, and I was sitting outside with my general manager, Shauna, one morning having coffee before we opened, and we saw a woman walking a dog across the street, and I went, the neighborhood just changed.
We've upscaled because someone has a Siberian Husky or something.
That meant a person was living here and had a pet. There was nobody in the West Loop when I got there.
It was. I'm sure so many of you went there. And we got to take a little break. And I want to talk to Ina. I have some idea about why. It wasn't like the landlord raised the rent. It wasn't like the place wasn't jammed. Why she decided that chapter of her life was over, and it's just one chapter. The book is Ina's Kitchen. Just look it up online and order it. We'll be right back. Joan Baez with one of the great songs that goes to the era in which, Ina Pinckney, when she was wandering around the village as a young lady, might have even bumped into Bob Dylan. I wonder what your parents would have said of, Mom, but his real name is Zimmerman. It's okay. Ina has been a delight for this entire time, and she ran Ina's Kitchen in 3 different locations. Her book is Ina's Kitchen, Memories and Recipes from the Breakfast Queen. It's charming on a million different levels. If you like to cook or at all adept at it, you have to buy it. And the recipes are easy, as she said to me, knowing my acumen mm-hmm. in the kitchen, foolproof. What's interesting, Ina, before we talk to you about why you decided that was that, and you did, you'd go out on top, which is a great thing. You know, I think the notion of community always is an important one to me. And I think what you created with that place intentionally with your staff and with your guests, whether they were first timers or regulars, is restaurant as community. You can tell me that I'm off base, but I always felt that about you and what you created there. Look, good food, good service, but there's something bigger going on there.
It's true. And if you remember in the movie, Alex Kotlowitz
yes.
says he felt like it was in a small town and he knew everybody. He'd walk in and he'd see people he knew. You know, there is this notion of hospitality that is lost so many times now.
Yeah.
When you walked in, it's the only retail situation where you come into this place to give me your money.
Yeah.
You don't come in and say, do you have that hamburger in blue? I'm just browsing. You know, and we have a responsibility to have this beautiful exchange of energy and care. I'm going to feed you this nourishing food in a nurturing environment, and you're going to pay me for it and be so happy, you're going to come back.
Yeah, that's
it's
rare.
It's very simple.
Sure.
But it's rare.
It is simple, but it's rare. The food scene in Chicago changed so radically and dramatically in your tenure here, where, you know, there's a new hot restaurant every week. It's like, you know, there's a new interesting kind of food. More power to all these chefs who are like mad scientists, frankly.
Well, I have a lot of respect for new and innovative, but I have more respect for consistency and tradition.
Yeah.
When I want a restaurant, I want to go and have a plate of food that's understandable, identifiable, and delicious. You know, just because it grows on the planet doesn't mean it all belongs on the same plate.
Yeah. I am so, you know, I really believe it's fine to be a foodie. And that's great if you people go to the next every hot new restaurant. But there is something to be said for that kind of normal. And I think most people are into the normal dining experience. Part of it is probably the rise of the Food Network that has made.
Oh, yes.
That has made this
stars out of people.
Yeah,
yeah. It's a strange thing that's happened. A woman asked me to meet with a friend's daughter who had just graduated from culinary school here, and I said I'd be delighted to talk to her. And we sat down, and I said, "So tell me, Zoe, what do you want to do?" And she said, "Oh, I want my own TV show." And I pushed back, and I went, "Well, my work here is done."
Wow.
I have nothing to say to anybody like that who's not willing to put in the time and the pain.
and I know that is one of the things. It may seem, and even people who see your movie will see you sort of joyfully sitting around, greeting people, hugging people. Running a restaurant is, okay, I will admit it's not like, you know, mining for coal in West Virginia. There are harder jobs. But I think most people do not. Who, if they've never done it, they have no idea. There must be 150 problems, little problems, and big, every day, Drew.
I always say that I had two jobs. One was to fill the place up, so I did it however I could, guerrilla marketing and all kinds of interviews and whatever. And the other job was to metabolize anxiety so that you came in as a guest, you had no idea that the walk-in freezer was down. You had no idea if there was a leak under the sink. You had no idea if the delivery was late for the eggs. It's not for you to know. It's for me to figure out how you should never know.
Oh, well, that's
and
so
run
well put.
And run the restaurant.
That does, and also it is caring for in a method that is at once den mother and psychoanalyst.
And rabbi and nurse, how many times I had to take out the anti-bleed kit.
and that staff, that staff was incredibly loyal. They were with you, many of them, almost from the beginning, right?
Very long time. Very long time.
What's the key to that?
The key to that is that they don't really like working for a woman, but I was already in a different category because I was older than a lot of their grandmothers.
Yeah.
And so they had this innate respect for that. Plus, I use very soft power. You would never hear me raise my voice unless I saw a dangerous situation. And I could get away with a lot by just saying, what you're doing is hurting me, and say it quietly, and then they would start to shake.
I ran it
like a gang. What can I tell
them?
You?
But fear in them.
Yeah, but with the quietest voice.
Was there a catalyst? Was there something that not a specific incident or something that convinced you that, well, this chapter is coming to a close?
It really had to do with my mobility. I was having a real struggle with the late effects of polio. We didn't know it was going to come back. And if I could take back all the hours of jazzercise in the 80s wearing pink leotards and purple leg warmers, I would take it back because I wore out whatever nerves and muscles that I had. So not being able to comfortably work a full day and having to sit in the back of the dining room, and then I had a stool behind the counter in the front, it was getting harder and harder. And I knew it was just, it was getting to be time.
When you told people, many of your longtime and deserved fans must have said, oh, please don't do this, because you were part of their lives.
Very true. I mean, they understood why I was doing it. I fed 3.5 generations of Chicagoans, and that was one of the reasons to write the book. So the first reason was because I had no family to whom to leave the recipes, and I had fed these families. So number one, we needed the book for that. Number two, I wanted to tell the stories of how I got from Brooklyn to breakfast royalty in Chicago. And number three, I wanted to write down the names of my family members who struggled so to get here from Russia to survive that I could thrive.
So
I needed to honor them and put it down in writing.
You're happy now. I mean, was there at one point in the 4 minutes we have left, was there a point, when in the movie, when you leave the restaurant, you're pretty together. You're holding it together pretty well. Was there a point? Was there
some, no?
No withdrawal. No withdrawal.
No
withdrawal.
No.
That's
when you've done something as well as you know how, when it's over, it's over.
Wow.
And I really knew it was the right thing to do. So right now I have a column for the Tribune.
In the Tribune.
I go out and eat breakfast and write about it once a month, Breakfast with Ina. I could not be happier with that. The film took on a life of its own.
Festivals
in 17 so far, and we just got into 4 more. And we keep winning awards for Best Short Documentary, which is just so overwhelmingly beautiful.
And the book is fantastic,
And
too.
The book, I love the book. And I love that you love the book.
I do. And you're also so gracious at the back to, you know, Ina's favorites, and she'll tell you a bunch of things that she loves, and she'll have
and
the
vendors
website.
That were so good to us and kind.
And it also, in a very, very, I don't know if this is a spoiler for you people. No, it's not. You're going to buy the book, aren't you? The last two pages feature salt and pepper shakers.
It kind of looks like ghosts.
Yeah, they ghostly. One is gray, one is white.
And what are they doing?
They both have tears.
They're both
in their
crying.
Eyes. They're
right?
both crying.
And Ina's recipe for life is:
never grieve until the day you have to. You
Amen.
Do seem so happy.
I am.
I'm so glad for you.
And I'm so happy to be with you here tonight. We've danced around each other for so many years that we would have this conversation.
I'm glad we did.
And I am too. Thank you.
I am glad we did. And plus the hearing, I will never forget. Someone will ask me years from now, did you ever hear, like, what's the best PR triumph anybody's had? I'll say, well, it's when Wally Phillips ordered one of Ina's cakes to deliver to
cups in it,
and then had Aaron Gold
write about it.
It doesn't get any better than that. What do you think, just in 1 minute, what do you think of the, because you started it all, of the breakfast scene in Chicago?
Oh, it was pretty grim for a while, but it's better now.
Is it?
I've had so many good meals of late. I think everybody who reads the column and goes out, no, I write about breakfast, not brunch. Brunch is not my beat.
Right.
So go out and eat weekday breakfast, and you will be so delighted at what's out there now.
That's great. You're a writer now. I'll read one more jacket quote before we
go.
David Axelrod. He is a political strategist at the Institute. He used to be a Tribune reporter, so he also knows good writing, and he likes to eat, David does. For all of us who are used to being fed well by our Jewish mothers, Inez is a delicious comfort, as is Ina herself. I could not echo those words more loudly. Dear, you are one of a kind.
Thank you.
One in a million.
Thank you.
This will be up online in a day or so, and order the book, please. It's Ina's Kitchen, Memories and Recipes from the Breakfast Queen by Ina Pinkney, with very, very beautiful photography by a fellow
named. As soon as we know, when we get distribution on the movie, I'll let you know and you can announce to people that it might be available for downstreaming somewhere.
Oh, it's a good movie. Thank you so much for letting me see it. It's great. It's also about Bill Pinkney, who is still black and still sails and is 80 years old, and he lives in Puerto Rico. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. Here with the news at 15 seconds.
I love you, Rick.
Close enough.
I love you too, honey.